The 2022 political field was intense, so don't get left behind in 2024. If you're running for political office, the first thing on your to-do list needs to be securing your name on the web. With a yourname.vote web domain from GoDaddy.com. Get yours now.
Welcome to another episode of Breaking Battlegrounds with your hosts Sam Stone and Chuck Warren. Another action-packed guest lineup for you today, folks. We're leading off with Congressman Dave Joyce of Ohio's 14th Congressional District. Congressman Joyce, a member of the House Committee on Appropriations, responsible for scrutinizing federal spending and determining how your tax dollars are spent, makes him a pretty important guy for all of us. Also chairman of House Appropriations Subcommittee on Homeland Security. Congressman Joyce, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
Congressman, I want to get into the budget vote this morning. But first, you had a primary this past Tuesday. How do you feel that Senate seat is looking? Are we going to pick up a seat, or is it going to be a tough, tight battle in Ohio?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You had three good candidates in there, and obviously Bernie Moreno won with a pretty big margin. That was unlike your polling that was out I'd seen the day before, so which had him, he and Matt Dolan in a more neck-and-neck race with a lot undecided, but obviously all the undecided broke Bernie's way. And I think it's he should have a open path now to a victory if, honestly, if we continue down the road we have with being as red as we have been. In the past, we've been more, as you all know, a bellwether state, and it doesn't appear that that's been trending in the last couple of elections. With President Trump at the top of the ticket, it'll certainly encourage turnout. However, I throw in a caveat that, you know, I've known Sherrod. He went, at the one time, he was my congressman. He was the Secretary of State, and then he was my congressman. And then he went on to beating DeWine in, I think it was 06. And he's been there ever since. So one thing you got underestimate Sherrod is his ability as a retail politician. He's very good about being out there in the field, shaking hands, making friends, and remembering them over the time that he's been in office. So I think it'll be a heated battle, but it should be pretty good pickings for Bernie if he continues down this path.
Congressman, is what you just said about Sherrod Brown, is that the advice? I mean, it's something we talk about on this program all the time, but too many of our politicians on our side of the aisle seem to be slipping into a digital campaign where they're not engaged in retail politics. How critical is that, and how much, especially in states like Ohio, does that make a difference?
You know, it's my own perception, obviously, but I think it makes a big difference because if people say, well, I know him, or I know his family, or his kids were on the same team as my kids, and you see that he's just another one of them. My thing has been, when I first got here, people were always, oh, Congressman, and I tell them, my name's Dave. I'm just Dave. And so he actually adopted that as a theme in 14 running, said, I'm just Dave. And so when people come up to you and they'll see you in a Home Depot or they'll see you at the Walmart or something, they're like, oh, it's just Dave. You know, you do your own shopping. Yeah, who the hell else is going to shop for me? So I think it just gives that little bit of like, hey, he's one of us type thing.
Right.
And there's a lot to said for that.
Yeah. We're with Congressman Joyce from Ohio. Congressman, all right, so you just got off the floor where the House passed by a two-thirds supermajority a $1.2 trillion package of spending bills, and now it's being sent to the Senate. Can you tell us what's in there you like? What is causing Freedom Caucus members to have a meltdown about it? And do you think this puts Speaker Johnson's speakership on the line?
Well, look, you know, for the homeland aspect, which has been my area, you know, over the course of the last week, it was held up because of homeland. And so I've been deeply involved in that. And it was just a fraction of the House Republican Conference is voting no on the package, no matter what. But that helps significantly weaken our hand at the negotiating table. We're a team that I was just laughing with Mike McCall this morning. I mean, we're like the team where 11 guys go out there and do whatever the hell they want when you're trying to execute a play. And if we would just stay focused and they saw that we would be able to do what Speaker McCarthy originally said when he got here, was that we were going to pass all 12 appropriation bills on a timely basis. and, you know, set the numbers and do that, I think we've been better off. But, you know, we proved this point on Monday when, again, when 40 of them signed a letter opposing the second package of funding bills without ever having seen it. And Senate leadership and Democrats know we can't pass something in the House on our own. We can't pass a rule, so therefore we have to do things on suspension, which requires Democratic votes. And so when it ended up, the White House stepping in with congressional Democrats, and they saw what the disaster a full-year CR was going to be to our defense, to our homeland, and other things, and they then stepped up and we started to get some movement on the things that I was fighting for all along, with stronger border security provisions in the bill, increase the beds to 41.5. They presently, even the union, after I spoke on the floor this morning, the Border Patrol union people came out and said this is a strong bill they need to support. And so I think it was important that we do that and be a stronger bill with more border security priorities. If we knew we had more Republicans, we would be on board from start to finish. So that's a problem, and it was a problem, you know, obviously defense, people can pretty much agree with defense, but then you had some other things, obviously, that people can pick and choose what they didn't like and find an off-ramp to vote no. And that's a shame, because if you want to get to know, you find something you don't like on the first page.
Right.
You don't have to read the whole bill to get there. But I think it's... you know, with the razor-thin majority we have, and I think that the Speaker, you got to give him credit for muscling this thing through, and I think we're going to continue down a path where when we get back, we'll start to do something about some foreign aid, and then the FISA bill and the FAA reauthorization, some other things that have been sitting on the table.
I've said for years one of the fundamental differences in Republican politics versus Democrat politics is they herd sheep and we herd cats. But fundamentally, that gives them an advantage in Congress, doesn't it? That they're aligned and moving together, and they move forward their party agenda, even when, you know, there may be a small amount of dissent in their ranks. They don't let that stop them. Whereas for us, that paralyzes us.
It's true. I mean, it's like we have 218, 19, whatever our current number is, independent agents.
Yeah.
And they run as a team. They work as a team and they run as a team. Now, they'll have some dissension, obviously, when you get to things like Israel, then, you know, that's divisive on their side, but not to the point that, you know, there's a number of folks on our side, obviously, who agree that, you know, our ally needs help at a time when they were attacked and we should be giving them that help without the restrictions that were initially placed on by the Speaker when he talked about getting the money from the IRS. So, you know, we have to start packaging these things in a smarter way and sell them to our members and start to build momentum. And that's the good part about now getting these two sets of bills under his feet. The Speaker has now done that. He's talked to and listened to everybody. And he's gotten to a point where I think the muscle memory will be intact. Hopefully we won't lose it in the 2 weeks we're gone. And then get back here and start to muscle some of these other bills through.
I want to quickly get to the bill that you're proposing with the Department of Homeland Security. But briefly, is Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene going to push to recall the Speaker? Or are we going to be able to have some sanity here and just finish out this session?
Well, you know, that all came, I was down on the floor prior to the vote giving my talk, and as well as other members of the appropriations, and then word broke on the floor that she had filed something. And, you know, if you remember, back when I got here in 13, Meadows did something similar. Maybe it was 14. Right before we left for August recess, he filed a motion and let it sit there. And he went home for the month. And instead of John calling the motion and then voting on it, because it probably would have been voted down then, it sat out there and sort of festered. And so people at home are building up, well, why aren't you going to support, or why are you going to support John Boehner? And so if that's what she's trying to get accomplished, to put him on notice that it's out there, I think that got accomplished. But again, the Speaker's a rough job.
Yeah.
It's one that, and especially for somebody like Speaker Johnson, because I joke to people at home, this, like, after the 3 weeks we went without a Speaker, and the number of people who tried to go, and then it was false starts and stops, that eventually you turn around, well, all right, who do we hate the least in this room? Oh, Mike
right.
Johnson. Oh, Mike Johnson, the speaker. And I was, it's speakers, one of those things where you got a guy like McCarthy, he'd been to everybody's district. He knew everybody. He knew
right.
the things that matter with you. And Mike was just another guy. And so it's taken him a while to meet and start to establish those relationships and realize who's in it to be a social media star and who's in it to actually get things done. And I think the last couple of weeks have proved to him that there's a lot of folks, especially when it comes to the appropriation process, who are serious about making sure that we batten down the hatches on spending and try to muscle through. The only way we're going to cure the problem at the border is in a change of administrations. You know, and we don't have the House, or we don't have the Senate, we don't have the presidency, so we're in a divided government, so you have to be able to work within the confines of that and try to get some of the things we did. We got a lot of good wins in there, if you think about it, and now we're off to 25, and that program is starting as soon as we get back as well.
Congressman, we have just about 2 minutes left here in the program, and thank you for joining us today. Tell us a little bit about the Homeland Security Appropriations Bill in the House that you've worked through.
Well, thanks. You know, one of the things that we had was the ability to, once we had that movement, as I was describing earlier, and got the White House involved, and they realized that they had a problem as well with it being a CR, that's when we got the serious things in there as far as getting money for the agents so that they could, you know, get paid and they hire more agents, because that's important for them, that we can retain the 41,500 beds. It'll be the maximum amount that they've ever had, and actually use those beds. You know, it's one thing to have them, and now that they've gotten somewhat serious because they realize what a problem they've created for themselves over the last 3.5 years, is that they're starting to fill all those beds. Those bills are 41,500 are currently filled. So we got to make sure that we can maintain those type of things. We also got money, and one of the big things that I've fought for since my time as a prosecutor is fentanyl. Something that kills 80,000 kids a year, we should declare war on. I mean, there's no discussion about
it.
So we're going to get $350 million to rapid scan type materials to keep at our ports of entry. So trucks, we have to get commerce going through those ports and move it in a fashion that, you know, gets the speed of business going at the same time.
It's absolutely critical, because here in Arizona, I've talked to numerous members of the business community who do business across the border. They are unbelievably frustrated right now with the delays in their cargo shipments coming north.
Right. And so if we could speed up that process by doing the rapid scan, it's important to stop the flow of fentanyl and to stop the flow of illegals, too, that, you know, as you well know down there, sometimes you have a trailer full of people.
Yep,
so
right.
it's important to make sure that we're doing those type of things and making sure that we're employing. We're going to spend money no matter what, but let's spend it on the best available technology.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Congressman Joyce, thank you so much for joining us. Folks, follow him at Rep. Dave Joyce on Twitter. Breaking Battlegrounds. We'll be right back.
At Overstock, we know home is a pretty important place, and that's why we believe everyone deserves a home that makes them happy. Whether you're furnishing a new house or apartment, or simply looking to update and refresh a few rooms, Overstock has everyday free shipping and amazing deals on the beautiful, high-quality furniture and decor you need to transform any home into the home of your dreams. Overstock, making dream homes come true.
Welcome back to Breaking Battlegrounds with your hosts, Sam Stone and Chuck Warren. We're going to be continuing on with our next guest, Evan Power, chairman of the Florida Republican Party, here in just a moment. But folks, you've been hearing us talk about YRefi for a while now. Check them out. Go to invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, and learn how you can earn up to a 10.25% fixed rate of return in their secure collateralized portfolio. It's a fantastic opportunity for you. So invest, the letter Y, then refy.com, or give them a call at 888-YRefy24. Chairman Power, thank you for joining us today. Really appreciate having you on the program. Florida just had some rather important elections and continues its trend red. Tell us a little bit about what went down and what your take is.
Well, we had elections in a bunch of municipalities across Florida this week, and we ended up picking up 4 seats that were held by Democrats in key places like Delray Beach, which is a +60 Biden district. We won the mayorship there. And then in the city of Clearwater, there is no longer any Democrat that holds office from local office all the way to Congress in Clearwater anymore. So I think it says big things about what we're doing in Florida to win Republican voters over.
What was the message? Was there a common message that the Republican candidate, and now, you know, supposedly these are always nonpartisan, and all of us here know that's sort of a lie in a lot of ways. Was there a common message that these candidates went and gave to the voters, or were they unique to each city? Because I think one thing people are getting frustrated about, which would seem to benefit Republicans, is they're tired of people pushing an agenda on cities where they just simply want, look, I want nice roads, I want a safe city, you know, the basics. I want basic services.
Yeah, I think there's a frustration with the idea of, you know, cities doing way more than they should. And what we've done in Florida is, on a state level, is govern conservatively over a long period of time and have the record to show it. So people are willing to give Republicans a chance to do something different.
How many of those races have swung, not just this year, but in the last few cycles? Are we seeing a big shift? I know we have now the mayor of Miami Beach is a Republican. That was a historic victory. Are we seeing this shift in multiple cycles now?
Yeah, we're seeing it in multiple cycles, and you're seeing it also in voter registration. We went from 2020, the Democrats having a 400,000 voter advantage, to now today we sit at 175,000 Republican advantage. And you're seeing that in flipping counties and flipping seats, you know, all across. You have state House members also in Miami Beach. You just see Republicans popping up in places that used to be Democrat strongholds.
What are you seeing as you go out to your various meetings, your LD meetings, you have your county meetings and so forth? What is the common theme that your Republican activists want the legislature to tackle, to pursue?
You know, they really want government out of their lives. I think nothing is more particular than when we were pushing what the media dubbed the Don't Say Gay bill, but simply letting parents be involved in their children's education. People just want the government out of their lives and let them be able to run their lives and be able to raise their children on their own and not have an agenda pushed down their throat. And I think that's really what has brought a lot of people over to our side.
I think that's a good insight. Is that a point that fundamentally, especially at the local government level, the difference right now between Republicans and Democrats is incredibly stark, which it wasn't in the past, where Democrats are using government, local government, to expand into every area of social engineering and really push impositions into people's lives. Is that the message Republicans, frankly, should be sending across the country, is we're running for these local elections to get out of your way?
Yeah, I think that is very helpful, and it's kind of in line with what all the voters and all the people and members of our local parties are thinking. I mean, just yesterday, the Broward County County Commission tried to pass a 0.25% sales tax to allow people to go get cancer screenings, and people are like, "Why are we paying? We have insurance for that. Why are we paying a sales tax to do something that's not the role of government?" And people just are getting frustrated with all of this extra things that Democrats are adding all over the place.
We're with Florida Republican Chairman Evan Power. Do you feel Democrats made a mistake by not holding a presidential primary? Was that helpful to the successes you experienced on Tuesday?
Yeah, I think it was extremely helpful. I think Nikki Fried made in her rush to get favor with Joe Biden, she denied her voters a chance to have their opinion made in the presidential race, and it hurt her turnout. I think that you look at a place like Palm Beach, where we turned out over 68% Republicans compared to their 20-something percent Democrat turnout. That makes the difference in some of these races.
Obviously, there's no way you can definitively answer this, but I wondered about RFK's strength in the state. How much would he eat into Democrats, into Joe Biden, if he were on the ballot in that Democrat primary? Is part of their concern tamping down his chances of appearing on the ballot or that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think that there's probably that fear from them because Joe Biden is not a popular figure in Florida. And if you look back at the last couple of elections, last cycle, Charlie Crist ran And I compare Joe Biden a lot to Charlie Crist as an older, old school politician who's kind of past his prime. And I think that the Democrat inspiration in Florida is kind of at that same Charlie Crist level, which led us to be able to win by nearly 20 points.
What do you attribute Donald Trump's success with Hispanic voters in Florida? And you have obviously Southern Florida for our audience to know, where you have a large Cuban, Venezuela, Colombian profile, and then more Central Florida, you have the Puerto Rican community up there. But what do you attribute his success to eating into a long held advantage of Democrats getting Hispanic votes?
Well, I think it goes back to some of this policy. You have Democrats trying to inject government into everything, and a lot of the immigrants, the Hispanic population is made of immigrants who've fled governments that were oppressive. So it makes it easy for them to want to side with us. And, in the governor's race in 2022, Ron DeSantis got 62% of the Hispanic vote. And you look Miami-Dade, we've picked up 20,000 new voters in Miami-Dade County in just the last 2 months. So it says a lot that it's just the policies that Republicans are saying, get government out of my life, is bringing them to our side.
Repeat that number again so our audience can tattoo that on their mind. What
That's
was that
amazing.
Number again?
Yeah.
DeSantis won 62% of the Hispanic vote in 2022, and we've picked up 20,000 new Republican voters in Miami-Dade County in the last 2 months alone.
That's just remarkable. What seats are you eyeing with? We have about a minute left here. What seats are you eyeing to flip in Florida currently? Are we just now down to local levels, municipal and counties? What are you looking at flipping?
Yeah, we're going to put a big emphasis on flipping county commission races, school board races, and city races. That way we do not allow Democrats to build a bench to be able to run against our good leaders. So I think the more we can win, the more we tamp down what they can do in the future.
What would you like voters who are deciding who to vote for president, Trump or Biden, what would you tell them why they should vote for Trump?
Well, if you look at the record in the past, Donald Trump left us a country that was secure, respected around the world, and we were safe. Joe Biden has destroyed all of that. And there's no way anyone can look back and go, we're doing much better under a Joe Biden administration. It makes it a very simple argument. We know what Donald Trump gave us for 4 years, and we need to return to that.
Chairman Power, before we let you go here real quick, how do people follow you and the Florida Republican Party and the work you're doing?
So we're on social media. I'm at Evan Power on X, and it's at Florida GOP. And you can go to florida.gop and find everything.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Evan Power, Chairman of the Florida Republican Party. Really appreciate having you on the program. Breaking Battlegrounds. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Breaking Battlegrounds with your host, Chuck Moore, and I'm Sam Stone. Our next guest up today, Kimberly Leonard, politics reporter and author of The Florida Playbook. She's based in Miami. Her coverage focuses on Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, former President Donald Trump, and the future of the conservative movement in the state. She has extensive experience covering financial disclosures, spending projections, and healthcare policy. But we have her on today to start out talking about Haiti. Kimberly Leonard, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can you give us an idea? Because I think this is one of those stories that's of enormous import, but people are maybe not following it as closely as they should be. What are the latest developments in Haiti?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a very difficult situation for people who are living there. There's violence everywhere. In every neighborhood, there is basically lawlessness across, nation. There are people going hungry because they're too afraid to leave their house because of the violence or kidnapping. They're running out of resources. And, as in the past, there have been concerns by the U.S. that people will, because they're desperate to, get to safety, that they will try to take the dangerous voyage across the sea, probably in unsafe vessels as well, to come to the U.S. or go to other places to escape. And so that's something that Florida is watching, and it's just been, a very difficult situation. We have 275,000 Haitians in Florida, especially in South Florida. So A lot of people who live in our state have friends and family who are back there.
Have you visited and done any interviews with people in Little Haiti there? That's about, you know, 39,000 people for folks listening to the show. It's a primarily Haitian community with some Hispanic culture there. But have you talked to anybody there, how they're feeling about it? Because I'm sure they all have family in Haiti right now.
Right. Well, I haven't actually gone on the ground there because I've been traveling a lot across lately. But I have, we have a state representative here. We actually have two state representatives here who are, who were born in Haiti and who are very concerned, who do have family back there. One lawmaker I spoke with, state lawmaker, was concerned because of kidnappings. And they're just completely distraught. And they're both Democrats. And so they're both, also unpleased with how, the state is responding. I think there's been a lot of looking for answers as well from the federal government. And so it's just been very, very emotional and difficult for the people who live here and who know so many people back in Haiti.
For our listeners, just so you want to know, Sam and I keep talking about Haiti. Here's a reason why. Okay, first of all, Haiti to Miami is 689 miles. Okay, Haiti to Washington, D.C. is 1,400 miles. Sam and I taped this out of Phoenix. We are 2,300 miles from D.C. So this is literally in Miami's backyard. And you have a country now that's the capital is 90% controlled by gangs. And there's only 9,000 cops in Haiti, and there's 200 gangs. So if you give 100 members per gang, you're about 20,000 gang members. I mean, they're outnumbered. I mean, how frightening to be there.
Yeah, I mean, it's been terrible. I can't even imagine.
So what is DeSantis doing about getting Floridians back to Florida?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
What is Governor DeSantis doing retrieving Floridians from Haiti and bringing them back to Florida? What's going on with that?
Sure. Earlier this week, the governor posted an online portal for people to be able to submit their information. It's only for U.S. citizens. And so what he's done is he's asked Floridians to fill out an online form if they need to get back. Airports have been shut down. So for people who are there, they are trapped. It's very dangerous. So what the governor has done, he and the emergency division here in Florida, is they've offered help. They will actually go to where people are, door-to-door service, essentially, to pick people up. And the very first flight arrived a couple nights ago. It was carrying, there were 14 people and most of them were children. And so what they've done is they've helped to fly people back. And they do say that where they're having trouble has been on the side of working with the federal government on there in order to, in terms of the U.S. federal government, in order to verify the identities of the people who are coming.
Okay.
So there's been some back and forth on that front. I have reached out to the State Department on that. I haven't heard back, but that was the main frustration that was expressed. You know, obviously it's a very dangerous situation, and so it's very risky. And I know that they had hoped to have four planes out this week, and they were only able to do one, in part because of the federal bureaucracy, as they describe it, but also just because it's so difficult to get in there and to figure out the logistics so that everyone gets in and out safely.
Fantastic. We're going to be coming back with more from Kimberly Leonard here in just a moment, folks. If you're not already, go to your favorite podcast site. Make sure you're subscribed to Breaking Battlegrounds. We have extra content for you every week via podcast. We will be back here in just a moment. We're going to continue on with Kimberly Leonard, talking more about Florida, about Haiti, everything that's going on there. And also, of course, check out the website, breakingbattlegrounds.vote. Got a great Substack, lots of good content from Chuck. Folks, stay tuned. We're coming right back.
At Overstock, we know home is a pretty important place, and that's why we believe everyone deserves a home that makes them happy. Whether you're furnishing a new house or apartment, or simply looking to update and refresh a few rooms, Overstock has everyday free shipping and amazing deals on the beautiful, high-quality furniture and decor you need to transform any home into the home of your dreams. Overstock, making dream homes come true.
Welcome back to Breaking Battlegrounds with your host, Chuck Warren. I'm Sam Stone. Folks, check out our friends at Y-Refi. They are offering a fantastic opportunity for you to earn up to a 10.25% rate of return in a secure collateralized portfolio. Fixed rate of return, fantastic flexibility. You can get your money back at any time, your principal back, no penalties. Here's the thing, folks. When you invest with YRefi, you're doing well for yourself by doing good for others because you're helping college students pay off their high interest college loans. It's a fantastic opportunity. Again, check it out. Invest in the letter Y, REFY.com, investYRefi.com, or give them a call at 888-YRefi24. We're continuing on now with Kimberly Leonard, politics reporter and author of the Florida Playbook. We're talking about Haiti. Kimberly, when we were talking about the initial response, she said there's a couple of legislators from Haiti who were born in Haiti who do not feel the state's response has been adequate or it should be done differently. What are they calling for and what are they saying needs to be done?
In the interview was how the governor is, you know, essentially going in with open arms to American citizens who are trapped in Haiti. But there's a second piece to that in that he has sent more State Guard members, more police officers down to the Keys to intercept anyone who isn't a U.S. citizen who tries to enter the United States. And that's to supplement what's going on the federal side. So the people who don't want to see that, you know, obviously it's a very political issue. It's a very heated issue that's not just affecting Haiti, also affects our southern border. So there's a lot of dispute between the parties about what's appropriate and what's the best way to conduct immigration policy.
Let me ask you this question, Kimberly. So basically what's happening is DeSantis is sending Florida resources down to retrieve Floridians from Haiti, correct? And
that's right.
And the two Haitian members of the legislature feel that he's putting more effort into keeping, I guess we'll call the Florida border shut. Is that basically the difference here, what we got?
Well, it's not that it's more effort necessarily, because we are going to see probably, I mean, there have been more than 300 requests that have come from Floridians to be rescued in Haiti. And so far we haven't seen a huge surge of migrants to cross. So it depends what the difference is, but they want, obviously, Haitians to be able to seek asylum when it's appropriate. And so they're a little bit concerned. And, you know, there's also a big dispute, not just in Florida, but nationally, about how involved states should be in policing undocumented immigration. And so that's sort of a piece of that as well, where they just disagree on the best approach.
Now, Kimberly, is this tied to, and I thought the wet foot, dry foot policy, as it's referred to, only applies to Cubans, because otherwise I would assume that a Haitian reaching U.S. shores under the current circumstance would have a pretty strong claim for asylum, much stronger than most of the people coming to our southern border, quite frankly.
We haven't gotten any indication from the federal government that that's the case. They do appear to be sent back to Haiti if they are intercepted at sea at this point.
Which
that doesn't mean that the policy might not change. There's a call for hearings in Congress, and there's calls for more clear guidance from the federal government. But so far, it seems to just be, you know, that people are being returned.
Sending anybody back to Haiti is a death sentence. That is just a horrible policy, period. Cuba. Let's talk quickly about Cuba. There's riots in Cuba. How does this affect southern Florida?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously huge, huge community of Cubans here. They've built Miami, where I live. And for the people who are watching that, I think that it's sort of, you have multiple crises happening, you know, at these international levels that are affecting Florida, potentially more people fleeing. I believe there was a vessel of about 25 migrants from Cuba who tried to come over this week. And, you know, same policy, they're being returned. But there's also a lot of protests happening right now. There are concerns about electricity usage, about food, and so there's just multiple crises right now happening right off of our shores that affect the communities of people that we have here in Florida.
Are you surprised by the resilience Donald Trump is having with the Hispanic population of southern Florida? What do you attribute that to?
I don't know if I'm surprised, because when I talk to people here, you know, I have a lot of neighbors and friends who are of Cuban descent or, you know, Colombian descent from Venezuela. And so I think that, you know, the way that they think about it is that he's been able to appeal to the community so much. And he has shown up, you know, for them. He does events. He has reached out. They've done a lot of outreach in you know, bilingual outreach. They feel connected to his message in terms of, you know, I think that they understand that, you know, the former president tends to speak in ways that are really imprecise, but they, you know, connect with that. So when, for example, last weekend he made a comment about how some undocumented people who commit crimes and then come to the U.S., he used the term, you know, not human and they're animals. If you talk to people, they say, no, he meant specifically people who have a criminal history, you know, who are coming here. They don't see it as meaning all immigrants. So they really do look at the context of some of the things that he says. And, you know, and I think a lot of it goes back to the ideas around the economy and how well, you know, you're able to become economically mobile about education and things like that, where they think back to pre-COVID and think, well, that was a time when things were more stable for them. It's just a big part of the appeal.
Kimberly, we just had on Evan Power, chairman of the Florida Republican Party. One of the questions we asked him, and I'd like to ask you also, is how big of a mistake was it? How impactful was it for the Florida Democrat Party not to have a presidential primary in the state? Because it seems like that may have fairly significantly affected their most recent election.
And he didn't dismiss it either.
Yeah.
Yeah, the chairman didn't dismiss
it. And we had an item in Florida Playbook about that that my colleague Gary Fineout wrote, and he did an excellent job on that. It had a little bit of effect. It does seem that both sides are kind of exaggerating the effects that it had.
Sure.
You know, but it did, you know, obviously it does affect turnout. I think that probably the bigger takeaway is actually for former President Trump. I mean, the patterns that we see in other states, I think, were surprising that we saw them here, too, because if you walk around Florida, you definitely get the impression that the former president is very popular here. And so the fact that he lost 1 in 5 GOP voters, a lot of Democrats are seeing as a positive sign for them. You know, does that mean they vote for President Joe Biden? Maybe not, but they might stay home. And so if they can make any inroads, then they might choose to do that. I mean, right now, the map that Democrats are looking at in terms of getting Biden to 270 in November does not come with Florida. They don't need it to win 270. But if down the line there seems to be more encouraging signs, if abortion is on the ballot in November, which we should know by next week, then that could very quickly change a lot of the dynamics and how much they feel like it's worth the investment here.
How long have you been in Florida now? I know you have.
I've been here 2.5 years.
Okay, so when you talk to the old timers there, and I'm sure you do in the press because you talk about, you want to get background, how has Florida changed over the past 8-10 years to today? What do they say? What's the differences they see?
Well, look, the biggest problem here is affordability right now. You know, it used to be a place where you could have a working class job and live a normal, stable life. But now we have a lot of issues with property insurance being expensive. And I think people don't really understand that who don't live in Florida. We're talking about $8,000 a year for a lot of people is what you're paying just for your property insurance to insure your house in case something goes wrong. Often you have to replace all your windows. That can be $30,000 right there just to be able to get insured, and you need the insurance to get a mortgage. HOA fees in apartments in Miami-Dade, I'm seeing a lot of $1,500 a month
is what you're paying
for the HOA fee.
Whoa.
So that's what's changed the most is the affordability piece of Florida.
How did this session go for DeSantis? He came back, he ran for president, he got out. Was the legislature cooperative with him, or did they show, this is sort of our show this session, what did you see?
Yeah, well, he kind of let them lead this session more than last time. You know, last time he set out a whole list of goals, and they gave him almost everything that he wanted. There were a couple of things he didn't get, but overall it was, you know, Ron DeSantis' session. This time he, for the first half, you know, he was up in Iowa campaigning, so when he came back, he there was some testing that was going on. There was the legislature passed a social media bill knowing that he was unhappy with it, and he vetoed it, and he pushed back, and he said, no way. Now, did they try to challenge him after that? No. They did what he wanted. They changed the bill, and then they moved forward. So he definitely is still ruling in the state. I think it'll be more telling, you know, what happens next session. And I can tell you right now that there's already talk, going back to the Haiti topic, there's already talk about potentially holding a special session soon to address the issue of undocumented immigration.
What do you think people should be looking for or watching for in Florida the rest of the year? What are some things that should be on their radar?
Ooh, well, what isn't there? There's a lot. So we have a U.S. Senate race. Rick Scott, who is also a two-term governor for the state, is up for re-election. And so that should be a pretty hotly contested race. I do know that Democrats are hoping to flip that seat. But he's a very wealthy man, and he's also, you know, been in politics here for a while. So it'll be a tough go. There's also a couple U.S. House races. Republicans are trying to flip one seat in the Orlando area, whereas Democrats are trying to flip two seats. One is Ana Paulina Luna. The other is Maria Salazar's seat. So that's what to watch with the election. One of the things I'm watching really closely is how seriously do Democrats take Florida? You know, Vice President Harris is coming into town this weekend. She's going to go to Parkland, Florida, which is, you know, the site of one of the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history. She'll be talking about gun safety there. And, you know, there is a lot of touching down on Florida. We don't see a huge investment here from Democrats, but that could change. We have a state Supreme Court who will be issuing decisions very soon on whether to put the issue of abortion rights on the ballot. So that would essentially,
that would change the electorate pretty significantly based on what we're seeing elsewhere.
It changes a margin for sure. Yeah.
It could, but you could also see a lot of, you know, frankly, a lot of Florida's different, right? You could definitely see a Florida that easily elects Trump and also passes abortion rights.
100%.
That is very, you know, an outcome that could very easily occur. And they also are weighing whether to put recreational marijuana on the ballot. So basically their deadline is April 1st, and they usually issue decisions on a Thursday. So that's why I'm saying, it's probably going to be.
Does Florida have medical marijuana?
Yes, I think they have medical marijuana, but they don't have recreational use. I can guarantee you there's probably a lot of Republicans that sort of hope it gets on the ballot, passes, and Trump wins, so the issue's just out of their hair. I mean, I've talked to, you know, I have a place in Florida. A lot of people just like, what's this 6 week stuff? Come on, it's this get on with life. So it'll be really fascinating. What do you think Democrats have to do to start having some electoral success again in Florida? Because they've not had it the past 2-3 cycles at all.
Well, they have to register more voters, first of all.
People have to want to register, right? I mean, right? You have to want to register as a Democrat, right? That's a part of the thing. So what do they need to do to get people excited about that again?
Well, look, they're underfunded, first of all, and they probably need help from national Democrats. It seems, I think that, I don't know if Democrats will acknowledge this, but there are often policies back in Washington that are inconsistent with what Florida Democrats might want, you know, that the D.C. Democratic apparatus might be okay with, for example, policies on Venezuela. And so there isn't always positions that are taken back in D.C. that are favorable to voters wanting to support Democrats. But, you know, they need to probably get funded more. They definitely are in line with issues in terms of, you know, talking about affordability a lot, talking about increasing healthcare access.
It's a long road they have back there. Kimberly, I apologize. I have to cut you off real quick. How do folks follow you and your work?
I'm Kimberly Leonard at Politico. Google me there.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Kimberly Leonard. At Politico and Florida Playbook, we really appreciate having her on the program today, folks. We will be back on the air next week, but make sure you download the podcast.
The 2022 political field was intense, so don't get left behind in 2024. If you're running for political office, the first thing on your to-do list needs to be securing your name on the web. With a yourname.vote web domain from GoDaddy.com. Get yours now.
All right, welcome to the podcast segment of Breaking Battlegrounds with your host, Chuck Warren. I'm Sam Stone, and of course, the irrepressible Kylie Kipper.
Yeah.
We have a Kipper's corner today.
Well, we could have a long Kipper's corner. There's okay, a lot. Well, Kylie's corner.
We have time.
Kylie's corner. Kylie's we call corner. It something different every week.
So what madness is controlling our world?
Before
now?
We get into that, I was just thinking about this the other day. The dichotomy between where Kylie's corner started as the sunshine corner.
Sunshine moment. Yeah.
Where we were giving wonderful, heartwarming news.
Yeah, we do sometimes.
And now mostly we talk about serial killers horrific murderers.
Yeah. Well, so last week I had talked about
mayhem sells.
Yeah. What sells? What gets clicks? I'm just kidding. This is what intrigues me. But last week I had talked about Riley Strain, and he was a student from Missouri that was visiting Tennessee, and his body was found this morning. This is Friday, so if you're listening to this later, it was found Friday, March 22nd in the Cumberland River. So it's...
By the way, what was interesting about that, I was listening to a report this morning, and the police were saying if he is in the river, his body will appear 14 to 21 days from this date, and today was the 14th day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so
They said it will come up 14 to 21 days, and they said today is the 14th day.
Okay.
Yeah, I did not know that.
Well, I guess like when it's really the water's really cold, it pulls the body down. So they were worried it would never resurface. But this week there was a lot of traction on the internet getting traction that his shirt was seen on a homeless man and that there was, you know, a possibility that he's still alive. And honestly, like I might have jumped on board that for a slight second. And then the police had said there's more footage because they're like, release all the footage because they released some of him walking through the town and going the direction. And they said that people were showing camera. TikTokers were going down there and showing cameras and they're like, release this footage. But they said the family has seen that footage and that's all that matters, which I imagine the footage that they weren't releasing is they probably saw him fall in because the family spokesperson said like, their family's on the river. They're on boats looking for him, which means if that shows you anything then they would be looking elsewhere if
correct
he was doing
right.
elsewhere. But very sad.
That's a tragedy for a family.
Yeah, horrible, horrible, horrible. Now changing subjects to...
By the way, I want to ask a question. So he was thrown out of the bar for being extremely drunk. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Do bar owners have some responsibility? I don't want to say liability, but some responsibility for start gauging people more and say, hey, hombre, three's enough. You're done.
Well, so it's reported he only bought one drink at that bar and two waters.
Okay.
And so he's probably drinking all day. So
Because he's with this frat buddy down to Nashville.
Yeah.
Okay.
This happened at 9 o'clock. So if you're that drunk at 9.
So... It depends, obviously, state to state, but there is some liability for a bar owner or a server who serves a visibly intoxicated person.
Correct.
Especially if they then get in their vehicle. So, in that situation, what bar owners are telling employees is put them in a taxi cab, put them in an Uber, get their keys, keep them here at the bar. But it's a drinking and driving thing. It's not a... every situation thing. Like if someone's just walking back to their hotel nearby or whatever, they're not going to intervene.
Sure.
Yeah. I don't know if there's an answer. Because what if you put them in the wrong car?
Well, the answer goes back to what I've talked about many times, and we have friends that do this, and I just said, why can't you just stop at 2? Why do you have to get blacked out? Why can't you just stop at 2 or 3? I've never understood it, I could never get them to drink 2 bottles of water. I mean, I don't get it. Anyway, continue.
It's hard to drink water sometimes.
Well, apparently.
Yeah. Anyway, so this topic sparked a few weeks ago when I read an article about Walmart implementing a subscription fee to use their self-checkouts. Have you guys heard about this?
No.
No.
Okay, so there's this article Fox posted. It said the next time you're shopping at Walmart, some self-checkout lanes may be available to subscription members only. So then I'm like, this is getting out of control. So I quickly Google and they're like, It's kind of true, but not true. The spokesperson said this decision is intended to better manage checkout availability, which I want to start with. There's never people checking out anyways. You're kind of forced to use self-checkout unless like there's one person working. So people with like 30 items in each, you know, cart, that takes a while. But
so these are, this is like the airport express lane, the first class lane, basically.
Yes.
Like I'm going to pay a fee and go.
For time.
Shorter line.
So it's not technically to use the self-checkout. It's a, Walmart has a subscription fee similar to Amazon for their online. And so they're saying if you have that, which is $12.95 a month, I believe. Yeah, $12.95 a month or $98 annually. There's going to be self-checkout lanes that are available only to you. And then people that don't have that can't use it. But this is where this is getting out of hand, the whole subscription situation. Is last night I was logging into my Netflix. And people may not know, but my husband's in Florida. And so he's using our Netflix account in Florida now. So we sometimes log in different places.
Sure.
And we just got kicked off my family's for having to get our own because we're in different households, right? So I finally did the thing. I got my own. I'm paying the $20, whatever it is a month.
$21.99.
Yes. And then last night I go to log in and it said, oh, add a family member. Learn more. There was no other option but to click learn more. So I clicked learn more and it's $7.99. If I wanted to add me, so we could watch in two separate places.
At the same time on the account.
Yes, and it said your new total will be $30.95. Netflix started at $10.
Well, Netflix is making money. There's a reason for it.
Netflix is making money.
But at this point, when I have kids, if my kids want to go to college and watch this, I'm going to be paying $100 a month just to watch Netflix.
I think the streaming industry as a whole, and this applies
this is out of control.
A lot more than Netflix. It's not achieved the promise that it had, which is you could go and stream anything you want at any time.
No.
You have to have subscriptions all over the place. It ends up, if you want the equivalent of what you had from a full cable package, you end up with a similar
cost. It's just a cable bundle.
Right.
There's no difference here. Now it's just streaming. But that you can access anytime versus if I had TNT or something.
But one of the things I think that needs to happen is consolidation in that. Like some of these need to come together, and you know, there's too many of them at this point.
Just have to go back to the regular TV, apparently.
They need to start buying. Well, I mean, that was the thing about the cable companies, right? They negotiated for the content from each of the providers, and then they offered that in a bundle.
And they often complained about the pricing for ESPN. ESPN says, well, look, we're event television. People come to us.
But I got to tell you, there's a need at this point. It's like I move around subscriptions, right? Because I don't want to pay for five sites or whatever it is. So I'll have two at a time. But then that becomes frustrating because, you know, okay, I want to watch this show tonight.
I know. I'm piggy about it. I'm spending over $100 a month just because when I want to watch something, I want to watch something.
I'm too Jewish.
Like a golf course.
I'm too Jewish for that, Chuck. I am way too Jewish for that. Like I have my Amazon. That's always there because I get the shipping stuff. Then I have one other that I just move that account
around. Well, what they do is they get you on a brilliant new creative new show. And it's like only eight, you know, it's unlike network TV used to be 24 episodes or 22. Yeah. Now it's like eight, right? You're like, well, I don't want to miss this.
Now I'm just left open ended too.
I mean, literally last night I was asked.
Yeah.
So what are you watching now? I mean, you get asked that a lot. What are you streaming now? That's a very common question now.
Yeah. Well, and you have good TV taste, so.
Yes, I do.
You get asked that more often than I do.
Impeccable TV taste.
Did you know, speaking of that, A&E canceled Longmire back in the day.
Yeah, now went on Netflix.
Which was their number one rated show ever.
Mm-hmm.
They canceled it not because of the ratings, not because people weren't watching it, but because it was watched by old people.
Yeah, no.
And not the 18 to 39.
It was probably more appropriate for CBS. It has Blue Bloods, NCIS, forth, right? So I mean, it's sort of like the old 30 Rock when they're trying to figure out how old Tracy Jordan was. And then they discovered... Well, he watches NCIS. He screams at the TV. He must be 72, right? And so it's the same type of demographic.
You guys are both looking at me like I have more. I do,
Well, there's two things I want to talk about before our podcast goes.
Okay, well,
go ahead.
I have two more.
Go ahead.
We could talk about Squatters or Kate Middleton.
We want to talk about, let's talk about Squatters.
Okay. I was going to say, the royal family does not intrigue me really at all.
Well, no.
Something weird's going on.
The only thing Kate Middleton has done, it has given me wonderful memes on social media of the before and afters of Kate Middleton. It's just all these various people. And that's just been the best thing. It's sort of like the bloodbath comment on Trump. And now it's like, you know, you know, what's the parody one called? Babylon Bee.
Yeah.
Where it's like, he quotes Trump says something about you know, drink water, and now Democrats are saying he's telling everybody to drown, you know, that type of thing. Right. So anyway, go ahead. So how about this squatter thing? It's weird.
I don't know. I don't even know where to begin. Why do they even have rights? Why does it exist?
Why do we have squatter rights?
So Phoenix actually looked into doing some of this a few years ago. And this started out of a group in Seattle and Washington that was a squatters' rights group that hid as a tenants' rights group. And you know, they got legislation in under the guise that it would protect, you know, young family from being evicted from a place they're paying for. And they framed it as, you know, if you could just give them a break and a little extra time, they could get back on their feet and they won't end up on the street. And then they inserted all this language that basically says if someone occupies a structure for various periods of time, depending in New York, it's 30 days. I think in Seattle, it's only like 7. Then they are a tenant and they have full tenants' rights under this bill, which expanded tenants' rights to make it almost impossible to evict people, to make it very expensive, long process.
But a tenant has a contract.
Yeah, but
squatter just walked right in and claimed.
So according to these laws that the Democrats have put in places like New York, in places like Boston, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., all in the West Coast cities, you are considered to have a contract if you've just been squatting on that property for the designated period of time. You have all the rights of someone who has a contract, only you're not paying.
It's just it makes no sense.
It doesn't make any sense.
In New York, well, okay, I don't know actually where in New York. I could be spreading false news, but somewhere we were discussing you can cancel the
utilities. New York, you cannot cancel the utilities. You have to leave. The owner of the property has to continue to pay.
I would cancel. I don't
care. Why have the New Yorkers just rebelled against this? I mean, I don't understand the logic to it.
Well, I don't understand the logic to a lot of what they're doing, right?
But it still doesn't make any sense.
No, I wonder if this incident being as high profile as it is will break through because...
But I'm sure every New Yorker knows somebody. I mean, it's like, you know, the 7 to 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon type thing. I'm sure there's a 3-degree separation in New York where everybody knows some squatter story of a real-life person, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's not some anonymous
name. Yeah, so this New York case, for instance, this guy is subleasing rooms in the basement in this, and he's actually making more in sublease than the rent on the unit was beforehand, right?
And he makes like 400 grand a year, the squatter.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel like that's a business.
So there's a video of a Arab man who's calling to his brothers overseas and say, come over here. I've figured out these squatters laws and we're taking over houses all across the United States and we're refusing to leave. And we've been in them for 6 months, 9 months, a year, that sort of thing. The entire fundamental basis of U.S. law is built around private property rights.
Correct.
I mean, this is the fundamental basis of Western law. And Democrats, I think this is just another example of them not liking the Western world.
Not liking property ownership.
Ignorantly not liking it because the alternatives are millions times worse.
I think it's very fundamental.
I just don't understand how you can, at this point where we're at in our world, how police can enforce any law. Like if I get pulled over right now, I don't want to pay a speeding ticket when there's all these other crazy.
But you will. And
I will. The problem, but I'm not, I don't want to. I'm going to bitch about it to my mom probably. Oh, am I allowed to say that? I
just had it's a podcast segment. Cool. You're good. Yeah.
Potty mouth.
Yeah. I'm forgetting his name, but the very tall libertarian actor who does a podcast now out in L.A., very famous. But anyway, he had a great segment on where he explained what was going on about 2 years ago. He said California has two sets of laws. They have one set of laws for people who have money in the bag.
Right.
Yeah.
And they have another set of laws for people who don't. And if you're one of the ones, you have money, they're coming after you because they're grabbing that money. It is a cash grab.
It's not equal justice anymore.
It's not equal justice. Whereas this person, they're just letting them do whatever they want, break whatever laws they want, go out
and they keep breaking it.
Chaos, and they keep breaking
it. It's like there was the Supreme Court judge that ruled that the illegal immigrant had the right to bear arms.
Yeah.
But they're illegal. They have no I don't understand how they rights. They don't live here.
It's actually
they do live
here,
but
one of the tenets of U.S. law is that only certain portions of the Bill of Rights applies to everybody within limits, but citizenship grants privileges that are not given to visitors.
Yeah.
Right. To people on visas, you're not you have equal protection under the law, but you do not have the right to keep and bear arms. That's a right of a citizen.
Yeah, judge ruled it somewhere in one of these states here.
Yeah, no, it's
one of the other 49 states.
I want to move on to, before we close this podcast, there's two things I want to talk about. So a poll came out from the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research. Now, just so you know, this has been around since 1990s. And I say this because I want to have some credibility to what they've reported, right? It's a nonprofit, and it's funded by the European Union and the Ford Foundation. So I don't view this group as being Orthodox pro-Israel. Is that fair to say?
Oh, gosh, no. Okay. No.
So they came out with a poll. This came out. They just did it March 5th through the 10th. Margin of error, 3%. They surveyed 1,580 Palestinians in Gaza, Judea, and Samaria. 93% of Palestinians say they believe Hamas did not commit atrocities during its mass invasion of Israel on October 7th. 72% support the attack. Think about that. 72% support the attack. In Gaza, support of the attack rose by 14 points since December, which makes sense because they're getting blown to hell.
Yeah.
In Judea and Samaria, support for the invasion dropped 11% to 71%. So we talked about this. Look, there are a lot of children being killed right now, either through bombing or malnutrition. So there's a part of my heart that says, you know, we need a ceasefire at least temporarily. But I see these numbers, and I'm just like with Israel, like, hell no. You return all the hostages first. If not, just you become rubble. I find this so appalling that they're okay with this.
Here's the thing. We had Kimberly Leonard on earlier, politics reporter, author of the Florida Playbook, talking about Haiti.
Right.
There's a significant parallel between the population, the Palestinian population and the Haitian population, in that nobody else who is familiar with that population in their region wants them.
Yeah.
And it's because they have been poisoned. The well has been poisoned.
Well, Egypt's a perfect example.
Yeah, Egypt won't take the Palestinians. I mean, have no interest in them.
I think many Americans wish they had the border security Egypt has to Gaza that we'd have on our southern border.
There is no crossing that border without...
I mean, look at this.
Yeah.
Gaza's support for Hamas continuing to rule the Gaza Strip has increased 14 points to more than 50% since December.
Yep.
And nearly 60% believe the terrorist group will remain in control of the territory. I mean, that is obscene. I mean, they're our enemy. Let's just call for what it is.
This is as much of a tragedy as this is. And it is.
Oh, it's horrible.
It's the same.
It's gut-wrenching.
It's in a different, you know, light, but the same sort of thing in Haiti. It's similar tragedy. But the fundamental issue here is that without reprogramming those populations, nobody believes they're fit en masse to live in their country. And they're not wrong.
Well, it's worse. It's worse in Gaza. I mean, with Haiti, there's just a cluster, right? It's gang control.
But you talk to the DR, they're like, we do not want that.
No. They don't want them over either.
Right.
And they'll keep it. One other topic before we leave here. So they came out with a new poll that talks about depression among kids. And depression, anxiety among American adolescents jumped more than 50% in multiple studies since 2010. Okay? The suicide rate for kids between 10 and 14 tripled between 2007 and 2021. The share of high school girls who seriously considered attempting suicide jumped from 19% to 30% in 21. You know, what I see here, and it goes back to me also the lockdowns, I blame a lot of this for two things. There's a lot of dysfunction in American families right now. I mean, it always goes back to family. So it's like the fentanyl crisis. Yes, we want to stop fentanyl from coming in, but you know, there's an easy way to stop the fentanyl crisis. Don't take drugs, right? So there's a real family factor in here. But you know what academics are trying to do is showing it's all social media. And I'm not saying social media is not part of the problem, but
it's part of it.
What they are teaching in public schools,
education.
What the press pushes every day, you're going to die because of climate warming. Everybody is a racist in America.
Yep.
You're not. How does this not, if you're an impressionable young person who does not have the ability to reason thoroughly yet, and they do not.
Right.
How on earth do you think this does not depress them? It's obscene. These people need to be held liable. Every day you turn around, there is some crap about we are all going to die from heat from global warming, or that, you know, this is a racist nation. You have no chance if you're a minority. Or America is a bad place to be a woman. None of these things are true.
No, none of them are. But, you know, I think it was the Wall Street Journal recently ran a graphic, overall happiness and rankings by age group.
Right.
The U.S. is below the UAE, below Slovenia, below Lithuania, the Czech Republic. And 60 and older in the U.S., top 10, 10th in happiness.
Right.
Generally pretty stable and happy. 30 and under, 62nd in country rank in the world. The lowest of any of
that
the OECD
That is a result
countries.
Of our news media and public education.
Yes.
And no one's – and that's what – if I was Heritage – or if I was the Hudson or some other, or Goldwater, that's a study I'd be doing.
Yes.
Because it is a big fact on this. One other factor on this, and this is where the dysfunction of family comes in. Since in the early 2000s, middle and high school kids saw friends in person 3 times a week. Now it's 1.5.
Yep.
You have to have social interaction.
Yep.
And that is the problem with social media, because they think they're interacting, but they are not interacting with people.
And even when they're together, you see kids in groups and they're all individually on their phone hanging out with one another.
Yeah,
it's like basically being next to each other is another text channel.
But I want to talk more on this, and Kylie, maybe we can find some experts. But I really blame this number for 30 and under on public education and the press.
Well, I really want Dr. Phil on the show. So that's who I'm trying to get.
Okay, well, there
you
have
it. Because
he
just wrote a new book. But it's about, he's saying, like, so you're talking about the happiness scale and all this, but he's like, it's okay not to be happy. There's days, right? Like, you're subject to it, but we're being taught in schools you have to be happy all the time.
And actually, for folks to pay attention, that's one of Jordan Peterson's things, right? Is that this idea that you're going to be happy all the time is false. And you have to be able to navigate when you're unhappy and be able to source the reason for it and address it within yourself. And we don't teach any of those skills. We teach these kids fundamentally all these issues you're hitting on, Chuck. It's the third world dictator answer for problems.
Correct.
To point at everybody else.
Correct.
Instead of pointing at yourself.
Correct. Correct. Well, great show this week. Sadly, Haiti, which is now 90% control in the capital by gangs, will probably be 95% next week because no one seems to be willing to do anything. But we'll keep talking about it, because I think that is a major issue that's going to have major ramifications
on our
border.
Haiti and Cuba are two countries I think we should intervene.
100%.
Without question.
I'm calling for the Monroe Doctrine again.
Yeah.
Let's do it. All right. On behalf of Kylie, Sam, Jeremy, who works hard, and myself, Chuck Warren, visit us at breakingbattlegrounds.vote or wherever you listen to your podcast and share it with your friends. Thanks a million. Have a great weekend.